Okay, we're recording now and start streaming. Did the refrigerator make all that noise? Okay.
I have an air conditioner going here at the hotel. Is that doing it maybe?
I don't hear anything coming from your guys. It's coming. It's my refrigerator over here, but it'll be all right. You can't really hear it much in the background. Schedule live. Okay, here we go. And we're going live. Good evening, everybody. Thanks for tuning in here. New Jersey Revolution Radio on the web at www.njrevolutionradio.com. We're here on a special night Sunday. We pop in on Sundays every once in a while. We have too much interesting stuff to fit into the Wednesday night alone. We come on Sunday, and we had some special guests here tonight. I want to welcome Randy Thompson of Help Not Handcuffs, a drug policy advocacy group here out of New Jersey, and also Brian K. Everett, who's works at Rutgers University and has done a lot of work in the area of drug policy. So thanks, guys, for joining me tonight. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, no problem. So the reason why we kind of started this was Randy advocates with former or with addicted people. His group is not, you know, mainly a bunch of lobbyists or a bunch of corporate people. I mean, we're talking about people who are affected by this disease. And you would think that Randy, you know, and his group would at least be heard when they have something to say. And unfortunately, that wasn't the case the other night. Randy, you want to give us a little bit of a story about what happened in Monmouth University? If you haven't heard it already, this has been posted on our Facebook page. But Randy, tell us what happened the other night.
Sure. Thanks, Brian. And you did a good job of leading off. Help Not Handcuffs is a community group. We did incorporate recently into a formal nonprofit. We also gained special consultative status with the United Nations Economic and Social Council. So even though we're volunteer individuals, we bring our message of promoting human rights inside of recovery and drug policy reform, whether it be at a local city council, at a county meeting, state legislature, or to the halls of the United Nations. So we try to make sure that we bring that perspective to those different areas, and also we gain information at each level of how things are done, what's done effectively, and what's done completely ineffectively or harmfully. So anyway, you know, we're local to Monmouth County, Asbury Park, and there was a promoted by the Attorney General and the Monmouth County Prosecutor's Office an opioid forum discussion, and that was reportedly open to the public. If you go to the Attorney General's 2121 initiative and you look up Monmouth County, you'll see it right there on Facebook, and there's no link for registration. So what we did is we alerted our members saying, hey, this is an important discussion, and I'm paraphrasing here. We need to be there, and we need to bring up the topics that are central to Help Not Handcuffs, which are addressing the harms of racist drug arrests, which particularly the organizer of this conference, you know, prosecutors, the AG, the Prevention Network, Preferred Behavioral Health, all these actors are very much an anti-drug, pro-prohibition message. And also police impunity. You know, we always look at, we don't, but many actors look at the police as being right. Leaders in reforming our drug policies. And we don't see that as a logical or a rational approach, given that the police are themselves not policed correctly. There's a lot of police impunity in the state. And looking at Monmouth County particularly, we can look at the examples of Tamara Seidel being murdered by the Neptune lieutenant, which was her husband. There's a dozen domestic violence calls to her house before that murder took place. So they dropped the ball there numerous times. Katie Thomas was arrested for a drug pipe and died in custody at the same police department. And recently, there was a guy who got pulled over for tailgating. A New Jersey state trooper thought he smelled marijuana and gave him a cavity search in broad daylight while other community members are driving by. Those are not necessarily errant harms that just happen to take place. Those are functional outcomes of having a racist prohibition policy and police impunity. You're going to get those outcomes when you don't address those two issues. So we said, let's go there. Let's participate in the conversation and raise these issues, especially being that the attorney general and the prosecutor are going to be there and these anti-drug groups. From the second we walked into the building, we didn't even get near the venue within the building. The police chief from Monmouth University campus said, "Are you Randy Thompson? Are you from Help Not Handcuff?" So I said, "Yeah, I happen to be speaking to an assistant prosecutor and Pastor Lydell Akins from Asbury Park." And he said, "We were alerted to the fact that you were coming here. We want to get you maybe a separate space where you could do your thing." I said, whoa, who alerted you? He said, well, he just shook his head. No, he's not going to tell me. He kept saying different things about if we wanted to be in a different area, he could set that up. I said, listen, we're coming here to participate in this conversation. So whatever you thought we were doing, that's all we're here. Right. So we went upstairs and from there, they said, oh, well, there's a registration. I said, well, there's no registration. We were invited here through the Attorney General's Facebook page. And they said, well, sorry, there was a registration link that was emailed out. I'm sorry if you didn't get it, but we're overfilled. We're overflowing in the room. We can't allow you in there. So I said, well, if I wait in their seats, can I get in? And she said, you can wait and do that. So other members came, some that are part of our group, some that are not. And we also happen to know a lot of people that were at the event that are not part of our group or part of, you know, our collective perspective.
Part of your community. Yeah.
But long story short is what came about is that the police chief circled back and kept saying, what are you doing? What's your plan? I just said, I'm waiting for a seat. He said, well, you can't wait here. You need to leave. I said, they just told me I could wait for a seat. And he says, no, I'm not going to let you wait. I was like, who's making that decision? He goes, that's my decision. So they literally escorted us out of the building. This is not Randy focused. That was me and another Help Not Handcuffs trustee, Jonna Sager, who also is a graduate student at the Monmouth University Graduate School of Public Policy. Not only that, other people who came were told, we're sorry that you didn't get the registration link, which again was not promoted in the press on the AG's Facebook page where dozens of people were responding, and they were told, we can't give you a seat because the room is overflowing. We knew people that were in there. Some of them took pictures. The room was half empty.
Yeah.
Not only that, as the last point, some of the people that were from our group were actually given a seat inside. They were sat down. They got to listen for a few minutes. A cop approached them and said, you need to leave. So we are completely unequivocally convinced that we were targeted, we were singled out, and we were discriminated against by the organizers of this event. So that's really...
And there's at any point, nobody gave you any indication as to why? I mean, did they think you were going to disrupt it? I guess they saw you as somebody that was there to protest as opposed to participate. But it's a public forum. You wait until somebody causes a disruption. It's crazy. I want to pull Brian here in on it for a minute because this really, you know, you gave us some context about policing and how law enforcement gets involved with the drug problem, whether it really hurts or helps anything. Brian, what's your experience with drug policy as far as law enforcement goes? Where do you think they need to do better? I would say they'd probably start by listening to the community first instead of throwing them out of forums. But let's start there with as far as your opinion goes.
So most of my opinion comes from my local hometown and the general area that I interact with, which is all sorts of towns within Camden County.
Yeah.
And for the most part, I really do think that the county as a whole has started to make a good trend towards really trying to find out what the community needs to combat addiction and to get people help instead of the constant cycle of arresting and, okay, you're still addicted and then you're going to get arrested again. One thing that I think needs to improve is the consistency of local governments, whether that's municipalities, counties, or the occasional state representative. It needs to be more of a consistent forum where they do ask for input from the community. And it needs to not just be a thing when we're about to approach November. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, you know, the state rotates around, and that's for sure. Now, when I first met Randy, you blew my mind a little bit with your positions on this stuff because it's so far departed from what we're used to here in America. But you basically, is it fair to say you just want to legalize everything? I mean, it's more complex than that, I understand, but that's a position that takes some getting used to even hearing because it's so far away from what we usually think of as a law enforcement issue, right? Where did you develop this philosophy? I mean, how did you come about advocating for total decriminalization?
Well, I mean, I guess if the simplest way of summing up what we want to accomplish is to get rid of drug prohibition policies because they have done nothing to prevent the production, distribution, and consumption of illicit substances. They've caused harm. They've grow literally organized crime like gangs, cartels, mafias, other transnational actors, and really replace those policies with human rights centered approaches that are proven, that have a factual basis with real outcomes to prove it, that they are helping make a healthier and stronger community. And those are particularly, like you said, if appropriate, outright commercialization. Certainly decriminalization of the substances. That way you're not criminalizing the people themselves, harm reduction. And those are the approaches that we've seen and learned about. You're asking how I came to that position. You know, personally, I had a long history of substance use, starting from when I faced a lot of adversity when I was a young adult, you know, acted out. We had some instability in housing and, you know, some environmental violence, things that, you know, sometimes kids go left or right of center, you know, when things are good. Of adversity, it's not an excuse, doesn't, you know, say, well, that's why, but it gives some understanding to why a kid would act out. Part of that was substance use. That substance use did become problematic, but it's real important that as I matured in my own general maturation process, but also in recovery, as people often refer to it, the things that were most detrimental to me, that were actually life-threatening, was the way I was treated because I was using an illicit substance. You know, attacked by an officer after an arrest because he knew he could get away with beating a drug addict. You know, how I was treated in a treatment center that I went into voluntarily, you know, with violence. These are the things that cause complex traumas that are, you know, completely intertwined with problematic drug use.
Yeah.
So when you look at how things are done in other places where they actually have real outcomes of lowering drug overdose rates, of improving the health and the social outcomes of people who do use drugs, even if they happen to be in a small minority that get addicted, they take the human rights-centered approach. And that could be the harm reduction program. That could be, you know, regulating the substance, maybe not commercializing it, but saying, you know, if people are addicted to injecting heroin, we're going to let them congregate here. We're going to give them clean heroin, and we're going to see them stabilize just as if we were stabilizing them on any other drug. And what happens there is they become stable, they stop getting arrested, and they get stronger health and social outcomes. So those are some of the approaches that we started to really formulate our policies around. And again, that's becoming informed from not just a local, a state, a national, but also the global perspective. When we go to the UN, we learn quite a bit about what works in other jurisdictions that, unfortunately, we're not even talking about here in New Jersey.
I've seen you guys banter a little bit on Facebook, and that's why I was excited to have you, because I think there's a good dialogue going between you, and I want to bring up something where I've seen some points of disagreement. In particular, so there's this generally accepted theory out there that a lot of opiate abuse starts with prescription painkillers, right? That you, somebody gets hurt, they go to the doctor, they get all these pills, and all of a sudden they're a drug addict. Well, not all of a sudden, but, you know, over time, one thing leads to another. And New Jersey passed a law, I believe last year, limiting the amount of prescription pills that you could get. And Brian, I know you were kind of, I believe you were somewhat in favor of this, maybe with some caveats, but you saw this as a way of preventing something before it got started. And I know, Randy, you disagree with that, so I'd like to hear that argument here on New Jersey Revolution Radio a little bit. Brian, can you explain your position as far as prescription opiates go?
So there's a lot of it's about a decade or more of research that was able to track the timeline of the addiction rate in the United States to opioids or to heroin. And it peaked at the same time that big pharmaceutical companies began this aggressive approach of marketing opioids on television or pushing them to doctors to use. There may have even been new uses that opioids were given, like breaking a bone came with a month's worth of oxycodone or something of the sort. So that was all new for the most part. And I was not much of a fan at all of the 8 years of Chris Christie, but I was a fan of the 7 day limit on opioid pills for typical things that you would perhaps go to the emergency room for, like a slip and fall or something of the sort, wisdom tooth removal. When we were able to track, the congruency between starting on a prescription-based opioid prescription and then ending up either maxing out bank accounts to buy them on the black market or then resorting to cheaper heroin. So I viewed that as a really good step to turn off the faucet in terms of the heroin and opioid epidemic. But there are a lot of caveats with that. A lot of chronically ill people have experienced some difficulty getting their medicine. So cancer patients, different types of arthritis patients, they've had a tougher time getting their opioids after this right. bill went through. And that's a simple policy error. There needs to be a way for those patients to still get their medicine. But for breaking an arm, for getting a tooth pulled, when we do know that there is the risk of addiction as the side effect to that drug, we don't need to be doing that. You can be taking ibuprofen and just fine.
I mean, I can attest to the fact that I've had prescriptions for opiates and I haven't developed an addiction, but I do have a bit of an addictive personality. I've had some other issues in my life. Just happens that opiates aren't one of them, thank God. But, you know, look, I'll admit, you get a toothache in a couple of days on painkillers. Those things are fun to be on. And I mean, they make you feel all right. I know they lead to bad things down the road, as any addictive substance are. But I do understand how it can happen. Randy, you disagree, though. You don't see this limit, these new limits, as being effective policy. Why not?
Well, I mean, first of all, it's not a real straightforward response. But I'll start with saying that it's sort of rooted in drug blaming. That and the anti-drug philosophy that heroin is the most evil thing and people cannot use that unless they've lost their souls and there's some evil controlling them. And it almost gets very religious. And the belief that prescription pills drive into that. So now, you know, okay, I'm not contesting the fact that there's some correlative data between increased prescribing and increased heroin use, but whether or not there's a causal relationship there or not, there's a lot of data that says that probably is not a causal factor. Just starting out, this is coming from the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. They have a large-scale national survey called the National Survey on Drug Use and Health. They did a sub-report on prescription drug use and misuse in the United States. They said out of the 119 million Americans 12 or older used prescription drugs in the last year, 97.5 million of them used pain relievers. That was over a third. And the absolute number of them that developed a prescription drug use disorder in the past year was 1%. Now, that's not a small amount of people. That's 2.7 million people. So you're talking about a lot of people that developed a prescription use disorder, but it's out of everybody, if you don't keep it in context, 99 out of 100 didn't have an issue. Just to back that up, I've got from the Cochrane Library, Long-Term Opioid Management for Chronic Non-Cancer Pain. That was 26 study, made an analysis, showed a 0.27 addiction rate. I've also got from the Wiley Exchanges, what percentage of chronic non-malignant pain patients exposed to chronic opioid therapy develop addiction. Out of 67 studies analyzed, they had an addiction rate of 3.27%. So we're talking about low percentages of people developing a substance use disorder. And I want to show you one last thing. This is another report that came out of the National Survey on Drug Use and Health. I hope you can see it. Is that coming up? This shows more than just prescription pain pills. This shows crack, heroin, sedatives, hallucinogens. These are people who 2 years ago did not use this drug, and they started out for the first year using them, and they followed up with them 2 years later. These are the percentages of the people that didn't use the drug anymore. So 68.4% of people using heroin who started it for the first time weren't using it anymore. Crack, 75.6% of the people who started using it 2 years ago weren't using it anymore. More importantly, who continued it and developed a dependence? Heroin, 13%. Now that's the biggest number there. But you gotta remember, drugs are not the evil that they're saying, where you use heroin once, you use crack once, you get addicted for life. That's the old anti-drug message. Crack, 3.2%. We're continuing use in dependence. So it's not necessarily you use prescription drugs, you develop addiction, you get to heroin. And the last thing I want to show you is from the Elsevier Journal. This is called Increased Use of Heroin as an Initiating Opioid of Abuse. And I'll just read you something in the abstract. It says, our data documents that as the most commonly prescribed opioids, hydrocodone and oxycodone became less accessible due to supply-side interventions, the use of heroin as an initiating opioid has grown at an alarming rate. That means people were not transitioning from prescription opioids onto heroin. It's what we've always known, is that people will experiment with drugs of different types. These people are going from absolute zero to trying heroin, because heroin's become very popularized, very available, very cheap in the community. And when we're talking about harms, like we wanted to bring up at the Monmouth University Forum, you can't talk about this discussion without talking about the harms of drug prohibition. Drug prohibition is bringing into all sorts of factors that are all lethal, including, most notably, fentanyl being mixed into different drugs, including drugs that it shouldn't, doesn't even make sense for them to be mixed into, like cocaine, like ecstasy pills. And that is a functional output of drug prohibition and nothing else. And I can say that because in countries where they have heroin-assisted treatment programs, where they give pharmaceutical-grade heroin to people who are already addicted, those people never die of a fentanyl overdose. That's the one place on earth where someone's not going to die. They don't die of heroin overdoses in that program, and they will never get a hot dose of fentanyl.
Brian, have you seen other models, like maybe in other countries or in other states that you've pulled ideas from? Do you have preferred kind of methods that you think should be employed here in New Jersey?
So a lot of what Randy said, it's an interesting topic, because there is certain data that says there's no correlation, and there's other data that, oh my gosh, this is the correlation. But like Randy also mentions with other countries, I'm all for clean heroin sites. I don't think that we should be in a society where that's like something you can actually go to the store and decide to do. I think that's too much of a that's coming from me in current Camden County mindset, where there is no such thing as clean heroin. But if there was to be a clean injection site, and they tried in Philadelphia recently, and I don't necessarily think it happened. I think it got shot down.
But they didn't start that program? I thought that the mayor had fired that program up. I thought it was approved.
I think it was approved, but then there was a lot of community backlash. I don't know if it ever got off the ground or not.
Not in my backyard, people, huh?
Yes. Yeah. And that's unfortunately what happens all throughout Camden County, too. They wanted to put an addiction center at a former Bancroft site, Bancroft School. And the community members refused it because they didn't want addicts in their neighborhood. Lo and behold, they were mostly people from that very neighborhood who needed help.
Yeah, it's The not in my backyard thing is annoying, basically, because people don't want it. But it's not like there's any community that's not affected by this. This is not a problem it's been a traditional problem that white people have ignored because we always thought of it as something that happened in Newark or Camden. And as segregated as New Jersey is, so is the drug problem. But it's ridiculous to think anybody could protest these things being in their communities because this problem is in all of our communities, you know?
I would just jump in and say it's not necessarily a problem because we know that people who use these drugs don't have any problem with it. They don't get addicted except for that small percentage. The problem is a policy problem that's executed more harshly in certain communities. That would be my perspective.
Do you see access to care for those that want treatment, though, as a problem? I mean, yeah, I have.
Because you have a prohibition machine that is arresting people, treating it like a human trafficking scheme, forcing bodies into treatment centers that profiteer off of bodies being forced in there. Meanwhile, someone who says, hey, I may have a legitimate substance use disorder, may I please try this program? Sorry, you need to wait.
Huge problem. The fact that there is that on one hand, you do have government trying to step in to provide better access to treatment beds, but I'm very nervous about how capitalist recovery has become. You see the billboards everywhere, and it's just this profit stream. And in Camden, actually, it's one of a total of 6 methadone treatment centers in South Jersey is located in the city of Camden because the other suburbs didn't want it there in their backyards. But think about recovery. You're supposed to avoid the places and the things that might make you crave the drug that you're trying to get clean from. Where were they buying the drugs most of the time? In Camden. And now the only place they can go for the methadone treatment is in the very place they used to buy the drugs.
Yeah, that's something I haven't thought about. I appreciate that view. So, Randy, I do want to make sure we can continue to support you. I'll tell you this, you know, since knowing you and helping you out a little bit with Help Not Handcuffs, I serve on the what board am I on? The advisory board. That's right. I know that Randy. I've been working with Randy a little over a year or two. Just had some conversations. He's asked me for advice a little bit along the way. I appreciate the effort that you put forth. I don't know that I've been all the way convinced yet that the complete decriminalization, but I do think it has to do with the way I was brought up and the way we've thought about drugs in this country. But certainly you've changed my mind quite a bit since we first met. What's next for Help Not Handcuffs? How do you plan on continuing to address this injustice from these actions? I did reach out before I put out your press release. I did reach out to Monmouth University Public Relations. I got no response. Really? Has there been a response? Do we look forward to more activity on your part? What's going on?
Yeah, we're trying to figure out what our next move is, too, because it's not something we want dropped. You know, we've got a lot of work, and again, we're an all-volunteer group with, you know, only one part-time staffer. So, you know, we've got to, you know, figure out our next move there, but we're definitely going to keep in a persistent fashion on this because that's absolute discrimination, and it needs to be understood that you can't have a forum talking about the affected population and then intentionally target and exclude the people you're talking about.
Crazy. But give platform to the prison industrial complex.
The prison industrial complex, the anti-drug complex, the prohibition industrial complex, all the people who are of yesterday's thinking are there talking unchallenged without any input necessarily. And I'm not saying that everybody who attended did not challenge them, but you know, from members of the community who have been negatively impacted, who certainly would have said something in a respectful manner, challenging them intellectually, not disrespectfully, we were targeted and excluded.
It's crazy. It's crazy. And Brian, how can we get in touch with you and follow your work? We know you're interested in this kind of stuff in Camden. Do you have any activities or websites or anything we should pay attention to?
No more website. I used to write a lot on my own domain. It was called the South Jersey Report. I got tired of paying the fee, so I got rid of it. But occasionally I write for BlueJersey.com. I also dabble here and there with the Save Jersey blog. The only time I'm able to appeal to Democrats and Republicans for the most part is about opioid policy, heroin epidemics, because it is like the only bipartisan issue that seems to make any progress these days.
Unfortunately, war is one of those issues too, but there's no anti-war. So if, there you go. There's two. You're always, if you want to give up trying to convince the Democrats and Republicans, come on NJR and convince communists. We're much easier. We're much easier.
Okay.
Much more fun. We appreciate having you guys on tonight. This podcast will go out soon. My kids are yelling in the background, so it's time for us to wrap up the show. But I appreciate you guys coming on tonight. Thanks a lot, everybody, on New Jersey Revolution Radio for tuning in, checking us out on Facebook Live. We could use some money. If you donate $25, you fund a week of our standing bills. It doesn't cost a lot to host a website and pay for some emails and Zoom accounts and stuff. So if you could pop on, or you could become like a $10 a month comrade. That's what we call our $10 a month club, our comrades, and you'll get a few special behind the scenes features if you do that as well. Stop by www.njrevolutionradio.com. Find out more about our organization. We really appreciate it. Have a good night, everybody.
Thanks, Brian.
See you.
All right. Cool. All right. So, Randy, I know you're already on the editorial board, and I'm going to start doing some stuff with that. Brian, you want to join our editorial board?
Sure. I like writing.
Basically, all it is I'm going to start putting out some emails when I'm doing panels like this. We have a Facebook group, stuff like that. It's just a resource for us to get content from, you know?
Okay.
All right, so I'll keep you guys in the loop, man. Thanks a lot. Randy, let me know, man, if more goes on with this, if you guys stage anything against the cops or whatever down there, let me know, and I'll do what I can for you. All right, brother?
All right.
Good night, guys.
Best of luck, Randy.
Thank you.